So as we continue in the book of Hebrews this morning, our passage is Hebrews 13, verses 1 to 6. Now, I've commented before on the variety that we meet in the pages of this book of Hebrews by New Testament standards. It's a fairly long book, but the writer retains the interest of his readers by every now and again changing tack. I don't mean that he does so in some kind of erratic and destabilizing way, but that there is definitely coherence and unity underlying the book, but in a pleasant and refreshing way, at certain points one feels as though one is entering new terrain in this book of Hebrews. And I think the beginning of chapter 13 is one such point, as we move then from the profound contrast there in the second half of chapter 12 between these two great covenants, as we move from that to the short, snappy, down-to-earth instructions now in this passage, the landscape clearly changes, doesn't it? We're not just picking up where we left off. This is a different kind of material now. Now, Hebrews is, as I've just said, a substantial New Testament book, and yet it's surprisingly short, is it not, of references to love. Love, we might think, is everywhere, is it not, in the New Testament? Well, not really in Hebrews. There are only two references to love that we've come across so far throughout 12 whole chapters. That's how much it has featured up until this point. But love does now feature here in chapter 13, verses 1 to 6. Actually, in terms of sheer vocabulary, even here, there's no proper usage of the word love. Agape is not there in the Greek text. But we do have several occurrences of a prefix meaning love. And more importantly, we have in this passage the concept of love. Love is certainly a very present concept here in these verses. In fact, C.S. Lewis might have talked about the four loves, but I want to suggest this morning that here in this passage we have three loves: what I'm going to call Christian love, marital love, and idolatrous love. So let's look at each of those in turn. First of all then, Christian love. Christian love. And this is verses 1 to 3. And when I say Christian love, then I'm using the phrase in the same sense in which we sang it just now. Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. So I'm talking then about love between Christians, the love that a Christian has for another Christian precisely because he or she is another Christian. And you notice then that our writer wants his readers to continue to practice that love. That's the word we have in the opening verse, let brotherly love continue. And that then sounds like an implicit commendation, doesn't it? That these readers, they already are practicing this Christian love, and they are simply to keep on doing so and to make sure that they maintain that Christian love into the future. And I think that probably is part of the meaning of verse 1. But I have a feeling there may be something else going on as well here. If you glance back for a moment to chapter 12, verse 27. This is what we read there. This phrase, yet once more, indicates the removal of things that are shaken, that is, things that have been made, in order that the things that cannot be shaken may remain. So that verse, you remember, it's saying there's going to be this great shaking of the cosmos itself one day at the end of time, after which a new order will emerge that will be unshakable, that will remain, as the writer puts it, that is, remain eternally. And interestingly, it's that same word remain which actually we have now in verse 1. It's really let brotherly love remain. And I think the writer may be hinting then that this Christian love that he's talking about here in verse 1, it also is going to remain eternally. It's going to be part of that unshakable new order that one day will be ushered in. So he's kind of saying, I think, in verse 1, let Christian love remain among you now in this life, because Christian love is going to remain among you forever and ever in that new world that God is going to bring about. You remember he made that point precisely in relation to peace and holiness in chapter 12. Remember we saw there the writer's point that you're heading for a new world that will be pervaded by peace and holiness, therefore practice and pursue peace and holiness now. And I think he's making the same point here in relation to love. Remember Jonathan Edwards' famous remark, heaven is a world of love. And the writer is saying then, as those who are going to be inhabitants of that world of love to come, make sure that love remains amongst you now. So I think there's a touch of that there in verse 1. But let's just notice then three features of this Christian love that is going to last forever. First of all, Christian love is familial. Christian love is familial. Because what does he call it there in verse 1? Brotherly love. Brotherly love. Now I said a moment ago that there are several occurrences in our passage of a prefix meaning love. It's that prefix phil. And we have it here in this word because the Greek word, of course, that the writer uses is Philadelphia, the love of brothers. Actually, the next occurrence of that prefix comes very soon afterwards in verse 2, where the phrase translated in our ESV, show hospitality to strangers, it's the Greek word philoxenia, which is the love of strangers then. It's actually a word that has been retained into our English language. We've turned it around and we have xenophile, a lover of foreigners, a lover of the outsider, a lover of strangers. So xenophobe is, of course, the opposite, someone who hates foreigners. And so the writer here in verse 2, he's exhorting his readers to love foreigners, to love outsiders, to love strangers. Now, almost certainly, the kind of people he has in mind here in verse 2 that he wants them to show love toward are Christians. I mean, we know, don't we, from our New Testaments that first century Christians were an astonishingly geographically mobile lot. So there constantly seems to be movement, doesn't there? Christians kind of traveling around from city to city. And that seems to be the background to verse 2 here. And the writer is envisaging then Christians who are passing through Rome, if that's the city where this letter went to, we don't know that for sure. But Christians who are passing through this city that this letter is going to, and the writer is saying, make sure that you show love to those people. And once we've established that, don't you detect a dollop of irony here in what he writes in verse 2? Because he says then in verse 2, show hospitality to strangers, show this love to strangers. But of course, in view of what he said in verse 1, these people who are Christians coming to your city, they're not really strangers at all. They're brothers and sisters. Yes, in a technical sense, they might be strangers because you've never met them before. That's how a non-Christian might describe the relationship between you and them. But the fact is, they have been adopted by grace into the same divine family into which you've been adopted by grace. So in the deepest sense, even though you've never met them before, they are your brothers and sisters. I think there's irony, I'm saying, in the way that he juxtaposes love of brothers in verse 1 and love of strangers in verse 2. The strangers aren't really strangers at all. And we need to be clear on that then, don't we? That in Christianity, we don't have teammates like at the sports club. We don't have comrades like in the Communist Party. We don't have buddies and friends like in the school playground. We have brothers and sisters, like in the family, because we are family. We're not simply fellow Christians. We're not simply co-believers. We're not simply colleagues in the faith. No, we are brothers and sisters. And when then we treat another Christian in a way that we would never dream of treating a natural sibling, that is a failure of Christian love, because Christian love is familial. If I harbour contempt for another member of my church, or indeed for Christians of a different denomination, the kind of contempt that would break my heart if I knew one of my children was showing it toward another of my children, then that is a failure of Christian love, because Christian love is familial. That's the first great point the writer is making here. Christian love is familial. But then secondly, Christian love is rewarding. Christian love is rewarding. Verse 2 continues then, "Don't neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." Now presumably he has in mind there certain Old Testament characters, Abraham in Genesis 18, Lot perhaps in Genesis 19 in the first instance. The hospitality was a meal. In the second instance it was a bed for the night. But in both cases then the guests turned out to be more than merely human. They were angelic visitors. So likely he has those kinds of instances in mind here. Is the writer suggesting that this phenomenon of disguised angelic visitations to the homes of believers may still occur? Well, yes, I think he probably is suggesting that. I mean, this writer clearly doesn't share, does he, our 21st century rationalistic embarrassment about these heavenly creatures. He said in chapter 1, verse 14, they exist to serve us. Not actually primarily to serve God. God doesn't need angels. They exist primarily to serve us. And he said, of course, in chapter 12, verse 22, that whenever we come like this and join in worship, we are joining with angels in our worship. So he probably does mean what the verse on face value seems to mean. Clearly, for our writer, there's not this great kind of distance between angels and us. There's mutual involvement. And he probably does mean then that when you practice Christian love, sometimes the object of that love may not actually be the Christian brother or sister that you think it is, but may in fact be an angel from heaven. So I think he is saying that, but he's surely making a broader point here as well, which is this, that when you practice Christian love, whether or not the object turns out to be an angel from heaven, often you will find that you experience great blessing yourself in practicing that love toward another. It isn't just a one-way thing, he's saying. It isn't just kind of me benefiting this person with whom I'm sharing my home and my time and my resources, but also this person is benefiting me as I show this hospitality and this love toward them. You remember how Peter says, doesn't he, in 1 Peter 4, verse 9, show hospitality toward one another without grumbling. Without grumbling. And the writer of Hebrews then is probably coming at this with that same presupposition that we don't find Christian love easy often. We naturally grumble that I'm having to put myself out to help others. I'm too busy to have these people into my home. It's too expensive. It's too stressful. I need some me time. I think the writer is coming from that same presupposition as Peter, that Christian love can be hard and it can go against our sinful, selfish instincts. And the writer is saying, yes, but remember there's another side to practicing Christian love. It also throws up blessings. Sometimes when you're least expecting them, Christian love is enriching. It's rewarding. And some of you, many of you I'm sure, can testify to this from personal experience. You've gotten involved with a Christian because of some need that that person was experiencing, and you attempted to meet that need. And perhaps at the time you got involved with little relish, simply because you felt it was the right thing to do. But as you look back now at how things have unfolded since then, and perhaps the friendship that has developed between you and that person, Or perhaps the way you've seen that person move on from that particular need they had back then and the way they've flourished since. As you look back now, you're so glad that you got involved with that person in their situation of need. Christian love is rewarding. So Christian love is familial, Christian love is rewarding. And then thirdly, Christian love is thoughtful. Christian love is thoughtful, and that's probably a bit of a feeble adjective really, but what I mean is that it's not tokenistic. Christian love isn't content then with some kind of perfunctory gesture of help or support that kind of salves the conscience and enables one to tick the box, yes, I practice Christian love, but doesn't really engage and grapple with the needy person's actual situation. Now, Christian love operates on Jesus' principle, do to others what you would have them do to you. Christian love asks the probing question, how would I want to be treated if I were in that situation that this person is now in? I think that's what our writer is getting at in verse 3. Now, I think we often misapply verse 3 because we underplay the significance of that opening word, remember. And we interpret it as simply a mental activity because, of course, often, you know, remembering what was on your shopping list, it is a mental activity. But, of course, in biblical terms, remembering is more than just a mental activity. And, you know, when the psalmists call on God to remember them, they're not simply asking God to kind of think about them and spare a passing thought for them. They're asking God to do something, to act on their behalf. In biblical terms, remembering someone is intervening and doing something and acting on their behalf. And so, although, of course, it's a good thing for us to remember in the mental sense Christians in prison in North Korea or Eritrea or wherever it may be and incorporate them into our prayers, that's a good, healthy thing. I don't think that's really what this verse is about. You see, the Christians who are in prison mentioned in this verse, they would have been members of the very congregation to whom the letter has been written. They weren't in prison thousands of miles away. They were in prison in Rome, in the same city that the letter was going to. And so when our writer tells his readers to remember them, he's not just saying, think about them. He's saying, go to the prison, take food, take clothes, take the things they need, help them. Give them the practical support and help that they need as they are in prison. And it's in that connection that he adds then, as though in prison with them. In other words, thinking deeply about what you would want from your Christian brothers and sisters if it was you who was languishing in that cell. That's the point he's making, thoughtful Christian love. And notice he mentions another category of Christians, doesn't he? In the same verse, those who are mistreated. So presumably these are also members of this congregation to which he's writing. And these guys perhaps haven't yet been put in prison, but they've been mistreated. Perhaps they've been subjected to physical beatings, physical punishments of some kind or another. And he wants them to remember them also. And again then, to do so, he says, since you also are in the body. And I think he's making the same point. He's saying, look, you know what it's like to have a body. You know what it's like to have skin that is easily cut and bruised and gets infected and is sore and keeps you awake at night. You know what it's like to have bruises that disfigure your face and embarrass you when you're amongst others. You know what it's like to have a body and These brothers and sisters of yours are suffering bodily because they've been beaten by the authorities. Think about what you would want right now if you were them. Enter into their shoes. Enter into their situation. Think about what would help them from their perspective, not simply from your perspective. And so you see the point then. Christian love is thoughtful. You see, it isn't thoughtful, is it? It isn't thoughtful love to spend 2 hours visiting a person who has been very ill and is so exhausted that they can't answer all these questions that you're firing at them. They just want to go and lie down and they want you to get out of their house as quickly as possible. It isn't thoughtful love to just dump a delicious frozen meal in the kitchen of a person who doesn't actually have the energy or the capability to defrost it and heat it up. I'm saying it's so easy, isn't it, to be slapdash and ham-fisted when we're actually supposedly helping another person. But Christian love, our writer is reminding us, is thoughtful. So Christian love then, that's the first type of love our writer addresses, and he says it's all these three things that we've just considered. But then secondly, let's move on and notice marital love. Marital love. And this is verse 4. Now there's a striking feature in the latter part of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. And it's the rapidity, I don't know whether you've noticed this yourselves reading through Ephesians, it's the rapidity with which Paul moves from writing about marriage to writing about the powers of evil and the sinister threat that the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms present. And sometimes when you're reading that last section of Ephesians, it kind of seems like a strange juxtaposition. Is Paul here just being a bit kind of mentally erratic going from that topic to this topic? But no, I don't think he is. I think that Paul's literary arrangement there in that last section of Ephesians, deliberately flags up a hugely important point, namely that marriage is a war zone. Marriage is a target of the powers of darkness. Now, of course, that idea can be exaggerated, and we must remember that as Christians, by definition, every part of our lives, we're targets of the powers of darkness, and that's irrespective of whether we're married or not. But nonetheless, in the midst of the romantic sentiments that we're often inclined to express on such occasions, we must always remember when a Christian couple enters into marriage, they are entering into something that will come under assault. Inevitably, it will be assaulted by the powers of evil. And I think our writer then shares those convictions with the Apostle Paul. Our writer may be the Apostle Paul, but he certainly shares those convictions. And in fact, in this verse then, in verse 4 of chapter 13, he's basically saying this. He's saying that if you are married then, you need to be aware that there are two points in particular at which your marriage is vulnerable to attack. I'm going to refer to these two points as perception and purity. Perception and purity. So first of all, perception. The verse begins, let marriage be held in honor. Let marriage be held in honor. In other words, make sure you perceive marriage as something honorable. Which suggests surely that there will be this temptation to perceive it as something not particularly honourable. Now again, I think this is a phrase that we often misapply as though it's just speaking of marriage in abstract terms. Marriage as an institution, marriage as a crucial building block of a fully functioning society, marriage as the proper setting in which to raise children and so on. We must honour marriage in those senses. And of course that's all true, and we should as Christians be clear on the arguments for why marriage is a healthy institution and why it is good for society and why it is the best setting for the raising of children and all the rest of it. But remember that this exhortation, let marriage be held in honour, it's really just one half of a double exhortation. And the next bit goes like this, and let the marriage bed be undefiled. Now we would rightly see that second exhortation, wouldn't we, as applying personally and directly, that every married Christian is here being challenged to make sure that his or her marriage bed remains undefiled. And I think it's consistent then for the first exhortation to be applied in that same way. And Every married Christian then is here being challenged to make sure that he or she is perceiving his or her marriage as an honourable thing. Not just marriage out there in some abstract sense, but my marriage. That's the point I think the writer is getting at. Do I regard my marriage as something precious and special and honourable? Because presumably then, for this writer, that's a point where every marriage is vulnerable to attack. There's this danger of a husband and wife, after a while, taking each other for granted, getting into a rut where they coexist under the same roof, but it's all very functional and they've lost this sense of how honourable their marriage is. As the angels in heaven look on that Christian marriage, they say, wow, look at this extraordinary relationship. That these two separate persons becoming one, and it's such a picture of Christ and his church, and it's such a picture of the great matrimony that's going to take place at the end of time. As the angels look on your marriage, they say, wow. But the writer is saying the danger is that you yourselves no longer look on your marriage and say, wow. That rather it becomes a situation where you just kind of, the husband refers to her as the wife, and the wife complains about his idiosyncrasies when she's out for coffee with her friends, and it all becomes toilsome and drudgery. And no, the writer is saying that should not be. Get your perception of your marriage right. See it as the angels see it. Recognize the honour that clings to it. Perhaps then you're married this morning and you need to take this point seriously of perception. Beware of a distorted perception, not of marriage in general, perhaps in terms of marriage in general, you're clear as crystal. You're subscribed to the Coalition for Marriage email list, and you write off to the Times to complain about silly proposals concerning no-fault divorces. You're bang on when it comes to marriage in general, but what about your perception of your own marriage? Del Ralph Davis comments, in a marriage, the real threat may not be infidelity, but simply a slow process of forgetting and a gradual failure to remember the preciousness of the other person. So perception, that's one point where marriage is vulnerable to attack, and then purity is the other. Purity, you know how you get, you buy a packet of fireworks and it says on the side, warning, contents flammable. Or you buy a packet of peanuts and a warning on the side, warning, may contain nuts. And you don't really need those kinds of warnings. And I suppose we may rightly think that we don't need this warning here. Let the marriage bed be undefiled. Because this is a pretty obvious point of vulnerability, isn't it? I mean, all of us know, I'm sure, marriages that have been at the least damaged and quite possibly destroyed in this way. Sexual impurity. And the writer then, he mentions the marriage bed, but of course this doesn't begin, does it, with the marriage bed being defiled. It begins back of that. The defiling of the marriage bed is the culmination of a process that begins with just unwise playing with fire, with spending too much time with another person, or allowing another person to take over your thoughts. And it's not dealt with, it's not checked, it's not restrained, and things go on until eventually the marriage bed is defiled. And we all then who are married need to be so vigilant on this particular point. By the way, it's striking language, isn't it? The marriage bed be undefiled. I mean, something can't be defiled, can it, unless it's holy and sacred in the first place. When I'm cleaning my running shoes after being in a running race in our front drive, and a bit of mud flies off and attaches itself to the wheelie bin. I don't say, oh no, the wheelie bin's been defiled by that, because the wheelie bin's pretty dirty and pretty unimpressive to begin with. If, on the other hand, a bit of that mud kind of landed on the living room wall, I might use that kind of language. And so, if the marriage bed can be defiled, it's a holy thing to start with. And again, there's a perception thing there, isn't there? Because, of course, our society will tell us that the biblical view of sexuality is so restrictive and so confining and so limiting that what happened in the 1960s was a liberation. And we can start to believe that lie. And yet, of course, the biblical view of sexuality, that exclusive physical relationship, the guarded marriage bed, it's a beautiful thing. It's a holy thing. It's a thing that, if damaged, is not simply damaged, but defiled, our writer says. And, by the way, as well, that the next bit of the verse, where the writer goes on, God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous, I think there's probably a background to that. We read, didn't we, in chapter 10, that some of these Christians were neglecting the meeting together of the believers, presumably the main Lord's Day gatherings. And we've said then that perhaps the main reason for that is that they've been drawn away to a different form of religion, actually, to the temple sacrifices and all that kind of thing that's going on in Jerusalem. But perhaps for one or two, there was another reason. Perhaps there were some believers in this congregation who had fallen into sexual immorality. Their marriages had been affected in this way that's been described here in this verse. And they were dealing with that by simply withdrawing from other Christians. And we're dealing with it particularly by withdrawing from the leadership of the church. It becomes clear later in this chapter that there are tensions between some of these believers and their leaders. The writer has to address that issue about respecting and honouring and obeying their leaders. And perhaps then there were these believers in this congregation, they'd fallen into sexual sin, their marriages had been damaged, perhaps had broken, and they were wanting to avoid church discipline, and so they were withdrawing from the church altogether. And I think the writer is saying here, look, you can do that. You can escape the elders of the church for the rest of your life, but you can't escape God. He knows what's gone on. God knows everything. So just repent of it, he's saying. Deal with it. You can hide it all from believers. You can just withdraw. You can just run away. But you can't hide any of it from God. Just repent, just sort it out, come back to God. That's the point he's making. And this morning there may be sexual sin in your life that has been hidden from everybody else. It's not hidden from God. Repent. Go to him. Confess and receive his forgiveness and restoration. So these then are the 2 points at which marriages are vulnerable, our writer is saying. Perception and purity. Make sure you perceive your marriage as honourable, and make sure that you are jealously defensive of the purity, the sexual purity of your marriage. Christian love, marital love. Thirdly and finally, idolatrous love. And this is just verses 5 and 6 then. Here we have that prefix again, actually, phil, the love of money. It's, again, that same prefix. And, of course, this love, unlike Christian love and marital love, isn't a positive, wholesome, healthy love. This is an idolatrous love that the writer is referring to, this love of money. And just 2 things then as we close. First of all, the antidote to this idolatry. The antidote to it. And we need to hear this because we live in a society then where we are tempted to this kind of idolatry, are we not, constantly? The love of money, making money, wealth, possessions, things, far too big a thing in our lives. So the antidote to this idolatry, what is it? What's the cure? What's the way of preventing it? Well, it's this. It's appreciating how much greater the real God is than this silly little God of money. That's the point our writer is making when he says, keep your life free from love of money, be content with what you have, for he, that is God, has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And his point surely is the contrast between money and God, because actually it's one of the scary features of money, isn't it, that it can leave you and forsake you very, very easily indeed. That's what the prodigal son discovered, isn't it, when he was in that far country. And he had such a huge amount of money that he went with. It evaporated pretty quickly. It's such an unstable, such an unreliable God, our writer is saying. It's inclined just to leave you destitute at any point. It's flimsy. The real God, on the other hand. The real God, he'll never leave you or forsake you. I think that's probably the point in verse 6 as well, where he says, so we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? You think, what's that got to do with what can man do to me? I think probably that's a reference back to a detail in chapter 10. Do you remember how in chapter 10, verse 34, there was a reference to a particular form of persecution these believers had experienced and perhaps were still experiencing, the plundering of their property, their possessions being taken. And I think his point then here now in chapter 13 is that if you make possessions your everything, your God, well, the authorities can come along one day and just strip you of them all. Carry your God away and it's gone in a moment. But when God is your God, man can't touch that. The bailiffs can't come along with a lorry and put Yahweh in the back of the lorry and drive off with him. They can't come away and put Jesus Christ in a box and remove him from your house. No, when Jesus Christ is your God, he is immovable and unshakable as your God. It's part of the comedy, isn't it, of Moses in Genesis, the way he describes Laban having those household gods. And they're so pathetic that his daughter can run off with them and he can chase after her on his camels and he can search the tents and not find them. Gods that can be stolen. Moses is saying, what a silly business. Gods that can be taken away. But actually, most of our society today is worshipping gods like Laban's household gods that could go in a moment. There was a financial crash in 2008 and many people overnight, their god just fell like Dagon to the floor and smashed to pieces. But when Jesus Christ is your God, can't happen. Can't be taken away. Can't suddenly evaporate. Can't wake up one morning finding yourself godless. And so the antidote to this idolatry is just realizing how infinitely better Jesus Christ is than the God of money. And of course it applies to any God, doesn't it? Anything we're tempted to put at the center of our lives. Jesus Christ is better, and the way that we'll avoid that idolatry is not by just telling ourselves, oh, I mustn't. The way that we'll avoid idolatry is by diverting our eyes to Jesus Christ and being so absorbed with how beautiful and great he is. And then the alternative to this idolatry. What's the alternative to it? That little word in verse 5, content. Be content with what you have. The alternative to loving money isn't hating money. That's never the biblical ideal, is it? The Bible never says, well, you should hate it and throw all your money in the bin and treat the stuff as vile. No, the alternative, the opposite, is to be content, which might be being content with a lot of money, because some Christians have lots of money. All of us, in fact, in world terms, have lots of money. Or it might be being content with very little, but it's just being content. That's the alternative. And so may God, help us this morning to practice Christian love. Those of us who are married, to practice marital love, avoiding those two dangers, and to avoid, all of us, this idolatrous love by worshipping Jesus Christ, not money or anything else. Amen.